This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. Sorry about those technical difficulties. It's Nate G here along with Dr. Doug Lyle. All right, Dr. Lyle, we're trying to get you off hold here. The button isn't working. But I do see you here.
Okay.
Here we go, Dr. Lyle. You're back on. Sorry about that.
Aha. Very good. All right. Fantastic. We pulled it off. Oop, am I still there? I have no idea what's happening.
There we go. Oh, Dr. Lyle,
can
how
you
are
hear
you doing
me?
This evening? Yep, now we got it.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Are you all right?
I'm okay. Yep.
Okay. Well, our high-priced studio work is sort of so-so. How are things going? Can you hear me now?
Yep, we can hear you now. I just got into some buttons clicking, and they delayed just enough to go through the intro.
Yep.
So, well, welcome, everybody. If you're new listeners, this is just how it is. You want to listen live, just go to www.blogtalkradio.com/beatyourgenes and just select the most recent show, and you can listen to us live as we do the show every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. But if it's not live, you can listen to us on any podcast app. So, Dr. Lyle, ready to power through?
Yes, we sure are. Absolutely.
All right. Fantastic. Well, we got a couple of questions here on committing to goals, displaying confidence, soulmates, and a very interesting question about why some guys like to push for sex immediately. So we'll start from the top. Dear Dr.
Okay.
Lyle, I'm 42, overweight, female, and I would like to be married. And I would still like to have kids, although I'm running out of time. I know exactly what I need to do to lose weight so I can feel better about myself and attract a mate, but I just can't commit to doing it. Why? Are these things actually not important to me, even though I think that they are?
Yeah, this is sort of a tough email, tough question. I would say that the things are important to this lady, but they're difficult. This is this is what Dr. Goldhammer and I call the pleasure trap, and that is that you have to realize that you're going against your instincts. It's not a simple matter of that you're going to learn how to crochet and then deciding whether or not you're going to do crochet, or you're going to have a nice garden and you're going to decide whether or not you go outside and work on your garden and make it nice. This is about going against your instincts, and literally directly against your instincts. And so this is what makes this difficult. Now, there's an additional problem here. There's more than one, but particularly this person is also procrastinating on the problem. There's a sense that when you are going to make a diet and lifestyle change to try to lose weight, that you're going into a shoot, you're kind of going into jail, and you're just going to have to grit your teeth and go through this thing to get out the other side and then get some goal. And then that goal is going to be probably temporary. And then you're going to give it all back. So you can kind of see this process, and this person's probably been through this process several times. And also, if she has dieted like most people have dieted, she has dieted in a way that she says she knows exactly what to do. She may or may not know exactly what to do. So a lot of people believe that they need to eat less and exercise more, and those are incorrect. Exercise has a limitation on how much good it can do you, so you don't need to do hardly any exercise at all to optimize your weight loss prospects. If you're doing 20 minutes a day of moderate exercise, that's about all it is that you would need to do about that. What you must do, though, you do not need to eat less than you want to. You have to eat things that you are that are consistent with the natural history of the organism and very low calorie density relative to the other foods that are out there. Problem is, your instincts are designed by nature to direct you to foods that are of the highest possible caloric density in the environment. So that's going to be things like bread, cheese, you know, ham, bacon, sausage, pancakes with syrup, donuts, Coca-Cola, Snickers bars, popcorn with butter on it, and everything else under the sun like this. And instead, we have to eat things like rice, beans, potatoes, oatmeal, bananas, you know, fruit, vegetable, salad, with nice little bits of avocado in there is fine, et cetera. This is what we need to eat. We need to eat low calorie density, whole natural foods. She may know this. If she's procrastinating on doing this, it's one of the reasons is that she kind of has a sense that she might not have to do it. This is another thing that goes on with people is that there's something that you want to do. What we can do is fiddle. And if we fiddle around long enough, we might not have to do it. So she's played the strategy of I'm going to assume that she has known what to do. As opposed to not knowing what to do. If you have do not know what to do, and what you are contemplating is eating less than you want, pushing yourself away from the table, going to bed hungry, gritting your teeth, and exercising a great deal, well, of course you don't want to do that, and those programs can crash and burn pretty quickly for people, because that's sort of self-torture. We're not asking for self-torture, and it's not required in order to become fit. What's required is that you morph your diet away from the drug-like allure of the high-calorie foods, high-rich foods, and move towards whole natural foods. You do not have to suffer particularly. All you have to do is morph your diet away from this, and you'll get used to it pretty soon. And then the trek is not that hard. Now, however, the person is procrastinating, and they don't want to do it. And one of the reasons is that all these years, she just might have landed somebody despite her weight, and that she wouldn't have had to do it at all. And so I would look at this. I would try for this person to shift your perspective a little bit, because at 42, you're almost out of time in terms of being a mom. The door is not completely closed, but it is almost shut. And so, you know, I'm probably going to get email from people saying, oh, no, I had my friend had a kid at 48. Yeah, there's outliers out there. But I'm telling you, at this age, 42, meet somebody by 43, get pregnant at 43 and a half, have a kid at 44, you are an outlier. That's not that typical to be able to have children that late. And so essentially, you're on the last lap of this derby. And so what I would tell you is that you should look at it this way, that you're going to just do this and you're going to get it over with. So spend the next 18 months of your life getting in the best shape that you've ever been in. So it's going to take you about probably 4 to 6 months to be in much better physical condition than you are now, to where it's really noticeable and affects your marketing of yourself. And spend a year trying to find Mr. Right. And then you can decide to mail it in. So have this attitude that, look, the door is almost shut. So you're either going to go for it or you're not. We can continue to play the procrastination strategy and fiddle around and just let the sands run out on the hourglass. But that isn't necessarily sort of going for the gusto here. My attitude would be to pin your ears back for once on this problem and really push, because then what we're not necessarily expecting to win, but what we can do is that for the rest of your life, we can have a degree of peace of mind that comes with knowing that you didn't just let this slip through your fingers out of your own sort of laziness and procrastination and fiddling, that instead what we did is we actually made a serious effort, and it either comes through or it doesn't come through. So one more short, determined push could bend the path of this person's life quite substantially. So my attitude would be to go fight for it. And if you're anywhere in the Western United States, and you're a plane flight away that's not even too troubling, you may want to go to Dr. Nathan Gershfeld's Fasting Escape for a kickstart if you can. This is just an idea, but I have, you know, seen many people go through this process where they need a kickstart. They need a place to go to get out of their environment, and they need a place to that sort of supports this. True North Health, McDougal Program, Engine 2, there's many options, but Nathan's is the newest beautiful place in Southern California that gives people a chance to really get a big push in the right direction. So this doesn't matter how you do it. I don't care. What I do care about is the watching an opportunity be fiddled away. This is a time to say, okay, listen, you don't have to do this forever. We can go back and live the way you're living now and be fine. But we've got one opportunity here. And if you had, you know, one opportunity to, I don't know, swing a baseball bat for $100,000, if you could get a hit off a major leaguer and they would put you behind a thing so and swear that you wouldn't get hit, you know, do you think that you could hit it? Probably not. But wouldn't you want to go out there and take a swing? I would. And that's what I would encourage this person to do.
Wow, fantastic.
All right.
I'm really thrilled, Dr. Lau, that we've got a baseball example out of you rather than a basketball example. But I like them both.
I'll just let really you like know that the basketball example occurred to me first. But I thought, you know, there's something about just taking one swing that fits here. So that's what my mind leaked over there, unfortunately.
Maybe one day we'll get a hockey example out of you.
Yeah, maybe. No, you were going to be here a long time.
Oh, yeah. All right.
Our
next question is a little bit along the same vein, which is about setting resolutions. And this particular one was about setting New Year's resolutions, which shows you just how backed up we are with questions. So we love the questions. Uh-huh. Keep sending them. And so here, Dr. Lyle, setting New Year's resolutions seems to be a universal phenomenon. Evolutionary basis for this? For example, periodically reflecting on your recent history and then determining what to improve?
I think that they're onto something here. And so the not a New Year's resolution, obviously, that wouldn't be part of evolution. But what and I don't think they're actually suggesting that. They're talking about something wider. Now, the concept of periodically stepping back and doing a wide-ranging analysis of the cost-benefit relationships in a person's life, which, of course, you have a cost-benefit relationship to, you know, in a thousand different ways to your environment. But you have a few cost-benefit relationships, particularly with respect to other people, relationships. And these are major. So there's half a dozen people in your life that take up most of your time, most of your energy, et cetera. And so, and there's a limited number of things that you do in this life that are your priorities that are essentially taking up the large share of your available time and energy. So it makes sense that from time to time we would analyze these things from a broader perspective and try to figure out whether or not some major shifts might optimize our life better. So let's just look at a few of what those things would be. Changing mates, changing the village that you're in, changing some costly behavior pattern that you seem to do. So you seem to argue with people, get into fights, and then have things blow up. From time to time, you might actually consider, now, wait a second, maybe I ought to rethink that. Maybe that's not the best strategy. So maybe I ought to quit, you know, trying to run this paint store that I bought from my uncle 14 years ago. And while I still have a chance, strike out and do something different on my own rather than continuing to run this paint store. And so this is the notion of the New Year's resolution is to look at, I mean, the New Year's resolution these days, everybody's resolution is to do what? Lose weight, because we're 42 years old and we haven't done anything about it and we're about out of time and we'd like some kids. Okay? So this is the most classic New Year's resolution is in America today is to lose weight. That wouldn't have been true 50 years ago. But what are we seeing? We're seeing people identifying a major problem with respect to them getting optimization of other relationships, other things that they would like in their life, and they see some things that are in the way. So that concept of thinking through what is getting in my way of optimizing my life. Do I need to possibly alter the way I'm looking at the value propositions of certain things? Is it worth it for me to continue to eat rich food, be overweight, not have a mate, not have kids? Okay, maybe I ought to rethink that. Is it worth continuing to smoke when I'm hacking up little pieces of my lung and my two brothers just got lung cancer this year? In other words, this is how it is, you know, New Year's resolutions. You know, I'm going to quit being such a doormat and keep saying yes to everything and then not having any time for myself. I need to figure out a way to stop doing this. So whether it's New Year's or not, periodically what will happen is people will take a step back and look at their life from a variety of perspectives and to see whether or not there might be a major shift, an alternative way to analyze the cost-benefit value propositions as to the way their life is integrated with multiple goals, and think maybe this isn't the right way to do it. Let me give you a kind of a wild example. I have a good friend that has lived and worked in the United States for much of his career. And he decided recently to move to his home foreign country. And he had been agonizing over this for a while. And then when he decided to do it, he was excited about it, but worried that he might miss the United States, et cetera, et cetera. Then when he did, all he can talk about is how wonderful it is in the new place, how much further his money goes, and how much better, you know, things are for him. So he had to agonize over such a change for a while, but he contemplated it. Major change requires contemplation. It requires sticking your toe in the water. It requires analyzing parameters before people are going to do these things. So, but this is part of the process of quote New Year's resolutions or any kind of resolution is about contemplating a major shift that may have a variety of consequences that we may not see and that may require, you know, a lot of adjustments. I'm trying to get something said here and I'm not spitting it out. Here's the deal. That the deal is that when we make a major change on anything, there are many unseen related costs and benefits that are difficult to imagine. And so this is what makes major change or major efforts on anything uncertain as to whether or not they're going to be worth it. So a lot of people may sit on their hands, like the person in question number one. There could be more to her sitting on her hands than just general laziness, not wanting to face the pleasure trap, etc. There could also be the ego trap, that if we were never married and haven't had kids and we're sort of this person who has been looked over by life, if we ever got in shape and then we were still looked over and couldn't find Mr. Right, then now we don't have that excuse to hold up to the world is the reason that stopped us. So there, I have no idea whether or not that has been an aspect of this particular person's situation, and very likely it has not been, but it could have been. And so this is an example of why it is that the mind absolutely will step back and try to think through major cost-benefit shifts, and sometimes have to mull them over and try to, you know, and use imagination and sometimes stick our toe in the water in order to try to grasp whether or not a major change may be worth it. Major changes have major possible benefits and major possible costs, and those will stop a lot of people from making major changes because of the inherent instability in a whole value matrix in their lives. That's why I'm trying to, in the case of the first question, trying to pitch this in a way that it is not, in fact, a major change, that we're not expecting to do it forever. We're not sure it's going to work in terms of finding a beneficial relationship. All I'm trying to go for is the peace of mind as we look back over our history later, that we did not let this opportunity slip through our fingers. So I'm trying to have a sense of urgency and time-limited commitment so to hopefully motivate the person to seize this opportunity while it's still in place. Okay. I think that's enough on that.
Okay. Yeah, and hopefully we won't wait till the next New Year's to answer a question. Sorry about that, everybody.
Sorry about that. It's July.
Yeah.
What can we say? All right.
What can we say? All right. Dear Dr. Lyle.
Yo.
This listener is quite shy, trip over my tongue in social situations, and blushes easily, and my eyes often automatically dart away when they meet the eyes of others. Mm-hmm. All of these feel really self-defeating in the modern world. Do all of these have the same source, and can I improve with practice or any other way?
They essentially do have the same source. This is a submissive kind of personality, agreeable, shy, probably all these sorts of things. And there are parameters that contribute to this that can absolutely change. The basic core personality is not going to change, but we could move from, I'm not sure where this person would be on sort of the shyness dimension. Sounds like they might be, anchoring down a far end of the bell curve at, 98th percentile for shy. And 98th percentile for shy can be a pretty hard way to go. In other words, it can be hard to find mates, friends, get jobs, et cetera. It isn't at all impossible, depending upon other characteristics of the person, how smart, how accomplished, how beautiful, all these things certainly have an impact on this whole situation. But let's suppose that the person is actually suffering a fair amount with respect to these issues. The question is, can we change where they are on the scale, and would it make a difference? The answer is, for some people, a modest change in where you are in terms of your ability to perform in these sorts of challenging situations could make a fairly big difference in your life. So we're not going to move your bedrock personality from the 98th percentile, but we can effectively probably move you down to the 90th percentile with practice. In other words, you can get ready for situations and rehearse and be more competent, and this can aid and abet your ability to perform, and therefore increase the likelihood that you can establish relationships that you might want to. So how can we do this? Well, there's a few parameters that are going to be involved here. Age is one of them. Basically, life experience in these situations is another. And also, success in almost any area of life can also matter. So any sort of expertise or accomplishment in anything, I don't really care what it is. Could be basket weaving, dominoes, perfume, anything. These are essentially islands of security in social discourse that are useful to have. It's useful to know a lot about something. And so when the conversation drifts towards those things, you can be more knowledgeable than anybody else, or at least, one of the most knowledgeable people in that situation. And you can feel confident even if you don't say anything. And then we're going to find that if this continues, what's going to happen is sooner or later you're going to find yourself taking a chance. Your brain will run a cost-benefit analysis. There'll be a moment where there's some discussion up, and there'll be a time when you don't have to contradict anybody, but you can add some anecdote that is interesting in the sense that other people are unlikely to know it. And as soon as you do that, the eyes turn to you and they recognize, oh, there's more going on there than we thought. And you're not bluffing, because that isn't the only little tidbit you know. You know quite a bit about whatever it is. So I think I remember a case somewhere along the way where I can't remember exactly why I'm coming up with this, but I've had a number of shy people, and we worked on ways to get better at certain social situations. One thing that let's suppose the person is a woman of in looking for dating and mating, that sort of thing. Let's suppose she's 35 years old or 28 years old or 42 years old or 53 years old and very shy. You can become an expert in sports. This is not difficult to do. You can become an expert in baseball, of all things. Why anyone would want to be an expert in baseball is hard for me to imagine.
Basketball.
Okay. My point is that if you became knowledgeable in baseball, then that is a conversation that no longer is intimidating to you, and you can actually speak up. And it doesn't take that much to be pretty knowledgeable. And so now suddenly you could be far more attractive and interesting to some guy who can talk to you about something. You know, he can actually talk to you in a way that he's comfortable talking because you're interested in baseball. You could be interested in cars the same way. You could learn all about, I don't know, muscle cars, anything under the sun. Or maybe you just want to be knowledgeable about perfumes or basket weaving or whatever it is that you're interested in. That's fine. But this is a way for you to sort of rehearse, become knowledgeable, et cetera, and to develop these little islands of expertise that will on topics that may come up in conversation. That's one thing to do. Also, obviously, you can rehearse general conversation and general questions and answers to the point where when people ask you something about yourself, you actually know what you're going to say. You don't have to think it through on the spot. So I think I spoke at a previous podcast about this, about a young lady that was very afraid of dating. And what we did was we actually came up with the 20 most common questions that would go back and forth in a date. And then what we did was we wrote answers to those questions. And then she memorized the answers to those questions and had interesting little anecdotes to say in several of them. So it's not like every question had something interesting. Every question she had an answer, and then a few of the questions she had marvelous, entertaining little things to say. And then she also understood that once you say your thing, then you turn right around and ask that person that same question themselves, so you get the spotlight off of you. So this worked fabulously well, by the way. And the strategy of scripting what you're going to say when you are shy, nervous, not sure what it is, this is exactly how you improve performance. I have a friend who is a top-notch national sales rep for the pharmaceutical industry. And she told me that their sales pitches and the queries about that they would have to answer from medical doctors were extremely carefully scripted. They had to practice over and over and over and over again. The doctor asks you this, this is what you say. Okay? The doctor says this is what you say back. So this is part of the job. Part of the job is to not just be socially comfortable and be smart and be attractive and just say intelligent things when the doctor talks to you. Not a chance. When they're trying to have that rep make that company $1 million a year from that rep's work, they are going to put that rep in a room and they are going to do repetition after repetition after repetition to make sure. That's why they call them reps. The this is so if they can do it, if big time salespeople can do it. I first learned about this as a teenager, being exposed to the master salesperson, Tom Hopkins of Champions Unlimited. I think he may be still around. I'm sure he's an old man now. But Tom Hopkins was the master at designing scripts, first for the real estate industry and then general sales, essentially telling salespeople exactly what to say, and so that you are not thinking off the cuff. This same the question is, can you improve? The answer is, you bet you can improve. We're not going to – it's not going to leak out into your general personality in any big way, but in performances where you – where it could be costing you, where you would dearly like to be better, you would like to be more confident, speak up, have something to say, and have it be valued by the group, so that you could so who it is that you are could be like a little flower opening up, so that somebody can see you, take notice of you, and then you could attract individuals for various relationships. Can you get better? You bet you can. Take some effort, take some work, not as much as you might think. I would say the lady that we did this for her dating, we probably took 4 sessions, and she did some homework in between. So probably in less than 10 hours of effort, this individual was very comfortable and competent meeting people for a 1-hour date. And that was a change. That was something that had not happened in 15 years of her dating career. So yes, you can. So that's what we can do.
Wow. Yeah. When you put it in terms of, 10 hours, it doesn't seem so bad. Whereas if it's like, oh,
right,
it's going to take you 6 weeks and, an hour and a half each or whatever, that's.
Yeah. Let's remember that this is how they make movies. So I can't remember what the story was. There's many stories out of Hollywood. There's, of course, a million stories out of Hollywood. But I believe I heard a story about Robert Shaw's soliloquy in Jaws, and where he's talking about he's the old seaman, the old sharker. And that, of course, is a little masterpiece. It goes on for, I think, 60 to maybe 90 seconds. And I believe that he practiced that for weeks. He was practicing that thing. So, there's a reason Jaws is Jaws and a bunch of other things are not Jaws. It's for parts of that performance that were so magnificent, but it didn't happen by chance. It happened by repetition. And so through those repetitions, we can improve performances markedly. And for most of us, this isn't relevant in most things of our lives, but whenever it is relevant in your life, understand that it is valuable, very valuable to rehearse. This can also be true for reasonably, normal people in the middle of the bell curve when they're looking at serious negotiations in their life, negotiations over the price of some item or a tough business call. Or something, or negotiating whether we're going to have to put all the kids in the car and head over to them for Thanksgiving 800 miles in the snow, and we don't want to do it. Okay, how are you going to negotiate with your mother-in-law about this, and how are you going to get out of it? The truth is that if you rehearse, very likely you can get out of this thing with elegance, whereas if you don't rehearse, you're not going to get out of it with elegance, and you're going to fold, and then you're going to be on the road swearing in the snow, okay? So this is rehearsal, planning, rehearsal, scripting. These are very useful things, and so this is a wider-ranging application than just the individual that asked this question. But this is underappreciated by the rank-and-file human in the world. It has not gone, obviously, without notice in Hollywood and in the acting world and the singing world, and it sure as heck hasn't gone unnoticed in the sales world at the highest levels. So when you need to sell yourself, or you need to sell a concept or an idea or a way that you're going to get out of something, very often it's useful to write a script, rehearse it several times, and get yourself ready. And so that's how this person can improve their performance.
All right. Next question. Dear Dr. Lyle.
Yes.
Is it common for a reasonably smart, independent woman to stay in an unloving marriage of over 30 years? Is being provided for enough of a trade-off for lack of mutual respect, fun, and great physical relationship too? Or are soulmates just a fantasy? Her question is, if a woman decides to stay in that unloving relationship, what are some ways to stay out of a trap or the pleasure trap?
Seems like a little tagline at the end. Gee, I could pitch Nathan's. All right.
FastEscape.com.
Let's look at this. I would say that, I have empathy for this question. My empathy, everybody's situation is different. Everybody has different circumstances. There's different, many different considerations. The sound of this sounds to me like I was just speaking about huge cost benefit, parameters being difficult to judge, and then people getting essentially intimidated because there's too many parameters that they can't see when they contemplate major change. This person is contemplating, really looking at this thing. Do I want to stay here in this situation that is psychologically a desert? But am I going to do it? Is it a worthy trade that I'm being cared for? Well, it's kind of an interesting comment saying, quote, independent woman. Independent how? She's not financially independent, or she wouldn't be talking about how it is that this is hooked to somebody else making a living, providing for her. Why are we not financially capable? Okay, this is the big question. And personal financial responsibility and capability, this is no small task. The median worker in the United States makes about $30,000 a year. The average worker in the United States, in other words, the average is about 60. That's because it's skewed because there's many people. It isn't like $30,000 is the middle of the bell curve, and then we go 30 to one side and 30 to the other, 0 to 60. No, we go all the way up to people making $1 million a year. So the average is $60,000 a year, but the median is 30. So that means that if you don't have a skill, if you don't have specific knowledge and skill, and you haven't been in a workplace where you've gone up some kind of step raises or a union or some government process where that they've stepped you up to a higher wage, even though your skill level is no different than people below you, if you're in private enterprise and you are unprotected by any such structure, then you could be, and you have no particular skill, then hard for you to be worth a lot of money. And life is expensive. And so as a result, a lot of people, particularly women, are in situations where they have maybe raised a couple of children. They've been in this relationship. It is now, what does she say? No love, no physical affection, no fun, whatever it is. Okay. And she's saying, wait a second, what am I doing here? I'm being financially supported. I would say the first step to this is to not be financially completely dependent. Now, if you're 72, we're having a different discussion than if you're 62 or 52. So she's been in the relationship 30-something years. Maybe she's 55 years old, and I don't know what the financial circumstances are, but my attitude would be, hey, no time like the present to go through the process of becoming financially independent. Okay, financial independence these days means, oh, you're rich and you never have to work again. No, financially independent means that you can support yourself and that you can support yourself at a standard of living where you're reasonably comfortable. That's what that is. Now, Incidentally, that can seem hard, that can seem inconvenient. I want to point out that that's the job of every adult animal in nature from the time animal life began. So, of course, if you are not in those circumstances, there's going to be some fear. Okay, there's some embarrassment, there's some fear. It's also inconvenient. There's effort that's involved. And all these things have to be weighed. And if you're asking me whether or not soulmates are a possibility and that is this just a fantasy, oh, it is absolutely a possibility. Of course that it's a possibility. And there are legitimately in love, happy people in the world. I've met a lot of them. So that is a real thing. Now, is there guarantees to that? No. Is there guarantees that you would ever find such a thing? Absolutely not. Just an opportunity. I look at this as sort of this individual's life is probably, I'm going to say, on a 1 to 10 scale for the amount of happiness that would be reasonably possible for a system to generate versus how miserable a person could be without not being in physical pain or in, you know, physical misery of some kind, starvation and cold and worried about whether the czar is going to cut your head off. This person is probably at a 5. Life's not too bad. They're being financially taken care for. They aren't working some onerous job. So the question is, do they sit there in that relationship or do they take a chance? Do they move on? Okay. Do they look for something better that would be much more appropriate for their personality and their life situation for them in terms of fulfillment in that relationship? We could see what the risk is. The risk is life could wind up being a 3. We could wind up having to work pretty long hours. We could, you know, we could lower our standard of living in some ways. There'd be some embarrassments about that. We might not ever find anybody, etc. So might just be 3 little heartbreaking relationships between us, and then that's the end of the story, and that's that. Okay? So we could wind up looking over our shoulder saying, well, I should have just stayed with John, okay? And then I would have been had a little better house and wouldn't have to work and wouldn't have to worry about this and that. Yep, that's true. On the other hand, you could have an 8. You could actually find someone wonderful and have your golden years be, you know, the most fulfilling relationship that you've ever had. Any guarantees? No, none. So what I would tell you is this, that the first thing that we would do in that situation is we could recognize that the nervous system is knocking hard on the door. Nervous system saying, hey, you don't want to be in this relationship. Okay. And so what we would want to do is say, okay, what's stopping us? Answer, money. Money's stopping us. So you have the opportunity to hustle, to start figuring out ways to become more valuable to the marketplace or figure out ways to make money. And throw ourselves into that problem. Now, this is useful because if it turns out after 6 months on the factory floor, this individual says, forget this. This is way too hard. I don't want any part of it. I'm going to stick with John and ride my way out. Then you've got more peace of mind. You've now discovered, you've now estimated the parameters. This is precisely what I was talking about with New Year's resolution CB problem. That what stops us from making moves is actually a finer grain analysis and feedback and estimation of parameters. So what we want to do is when we see a problem like this, these problems like this, this is like a red flag in front of a bull for me. My attitude is let's go right into the teeth of this thing. The fundamental problem here is money. The fundamental problem here is financial independence. I can't tell you how many people, when I have posed the question as they're analyzing how they feel about the relationship, I say, okay, a long-lost Aunt Millie just died, and it turns out you're the only heir, and she's bequeathed $3 million to you. Okay, now what are you going to do? And you know what I've had many people say? I'd be gone by lunch. Okay, that's it. All right, so okay, we've got our answer then. we now know how valuable this relationship really is to you, because you wouldn't even stay for dinner. That's how valuable it is. That's how reasonably unhappy you are with that situation. So you're not going to make $3 million, but you could put yourself in a position with effort. It might be possible for you to become financially independent. And then you have to decide what it's worth. And so what we do is we discover whether or not we can become independent. We go to the work, we go to the trouble, we go to the sweat of getting up in the morning, setting our alarm clock, et cetera, and packing our lunch and going to work. And then we find out whether or not how we feel about it. We'll learn something in the process. So that's what I would tell to this lady. And I don't know whether it makes any sense, because for all I know, she could be 75 and it may not be in any way reasonable to be even thinking along those lines. But she said 30 years. My guess is she was married in her 20s. She's probably in her late 50s. She's looking at this whole thing and trying to figure out, what am I going to do? Am I going to be with this guy for the next 20, 25 years? Is that how I'm going to do it? And I would say, you know what? If you're not very happy, look hard at the alternatives. Be willing to put some energy out to stick your toe in a new direction very safely, to find out what this all might feel like, and then make your decision then. That's what I would say.
Fantastic. Dr. Lyle, what do you think? We got time for one more question?
You know, actually, no. I have one thing that I wanted to say that I was told to do. I forgot. And part of it's self-serving, and part of it I get to do that really from the heart. Our good friend of mine, Chef AJ, I wish I had pitched this earlier so that everybody could hear it. She was recently elected to the Vegetarian Hall of Fame, a super deserving recipient, along with Mahatma Gandhi and T. Colin Campbell and people like this. Chef AJ is a tireless worker in this domain, and so I'm really, really pleased that this happened. Yeah, it turns out that she came to Alan Goldhammer and I don't know, a year or so ago, and said, hey, have you guys ever thought about having your book, you know, read? And, of course, we hadn't. And she said, well, you ought to do it. And, like, we're too lazy and busy, and so we weren't going to do it. And she said, well, I'll do it. And so she took it upon herself to be the reader of the audiobook version of The Pleasure Trap, which was just terrific. And she did a great job, and she is interviewing us on Sunday morning at 11 a.m., and I don't know how you would find this, because I don't know anything about it, because like I said, I'm kind of a flake, but it's Chef AJ is going to be doing this thing, and Alan and I are going to take time out Sunday morning to do this. And she's going to talk to us about The Pleasure Trap and questions about it and so on and so forth. So I'm supposed to pitch that, so I just did my duty. But the main thing I wanted to tell people was congratulations to AJ on you know, being recognized for her remarkable contributions in this area.
It's fantastic. And what I'm going to do is I have the link for the webinar. That's this Sunday at 11 o'clock Pacific Standard Time. Oh, no, it's General Mountain Time. But I'll put the link for that webinar up into the show description. And for those of you who want to join, it's going to be with you and Dr. Lyle, right?
No, I'm Dr. Lyle.
Yeah, you and Dr. Goldhammer. I'm sorry about that.
It's late. You're a busy guy. All right. All good.
All right. Fantastic. I'm going to put up here in the description that everyone can just click on it and register for that webinar.
Sure. Great. All right, sir.
All right.
We good?
We are good to go. We'll talk about the other question about why some guys get pushy for sex next week. Dr. Lyle, thanks as always, and we'll talk to you next week.
Great. Great talking to you. See you soon.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.
I'm in Glendale and found love in the South Bay. Yes, I find myself in an LA long distance thing. Guess who helped make it work? AT&T. I bought one phone, got another one on them. And romance is alive on the 101.
Come into an AT&T store, buy a smartphone, and get one on us. More for your thing. That's our thing.
Limited time in areas. Select devices. Each requires up to $900 on installment agreement. Requires one new line of minimum $75 per month service. Free after credits over 30 months starting within 3 bills. If canceled service, device balance is due. $30 activation, additional fees, taxes, and restrictions apply. See your local AT&T store for details.